Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who I have had the privilege of being, well, comrades in arms with over many years in that war. A man who I have learned much from and been an admirer of through thick and through thin. I'm very pleased, is here for a full hour of conversation. This is a chance to explore a very dynamic and increasingly, I think, dangerous world with a man who has served at the highest levels of the United States government in moments, as he calls it, of war and decision. I'm speaking, of course, of Douglas J. Feith, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the days immediately after 9/11, the author of a superb memoir on that period. He served from 2001 to 2005 in the Pentagon, among several tours of duty there. The book is entitled War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. He is these days a senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute, and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Doug Feith, thank you so much for joining us and for your generous allocation of time for the purpose today. Welcome back.
Happy to be with you.
Doug, you and I fought manfully back in the day when we were told the world was going to be rid of chemical weapons if only we signed on to a convention on the elimination, the prohibition and elimination of such weapons worldwide. I'm speaking to you in the immediate aftermath of what certainly seems to be yet another horrific use of chemical weapons by Bashar Assad of Syria against innocent civilians with murderous effects. This is now setting up the question of what to do about it, but I thought I might just start with the question, was it a mistake to go down this road, leaving in the hands of only the likes of, Bashar Assad and his Russian sponsors and the Chinese and the like, the access to and potential use of such weapons?
The news reports about the Assad regime in Syria using chemical weapons are strategically important for the United States for a number of reasons, and a lot of those relate to the strategic problems posed to us of Assad's winning his civil war and the Iranian backing of the Assad regime. And I mean, there are a lot of aspects to this that are deeply troubling. You have called attention to, I think, an important aspect, which is the belief that we can take a legal approach to handling problems like, you know, the viciousness of the Assad regime, a legal approach to the problem of chemical weapons. That I think the news that we're seeing that chemical weapons are being used by the Assad regime, despite that regime's legal obligation to not possess those weapons, let alone use them, is one more illustration out of many that the arms control approach to dealing with problems of this kind is based on hopes that are not well grounded, hopes that criminal regimes, vicious regimes, regimes that have no respect for the law are going to be constrained by their promises to adhere to treaties. And the 20th century was full of examples of well-meaning people trying to solve problems relating to war and weapons and peace through arms control and peace agreements. And lo and behold, the non-democratic parties to those agreements showed that they don't have any respect for the agreements. And when they violated them, And this was true with the Germans after World War One. It was true with the Soviets throughout the Cold War. It was true with other regimes that were, you know, tyrannical and non-democratic. The problem is that when those regimes violated their legal obligations, the Western democracies basically did nothing about it. And so you have this remarkable phenomenon of time after time, people in the Western world putting a lot of faith in legal approaches to these problems, in arms control and peace agreements. And then they enter into agreements with non-democratic parties. The non-democratic parties violate the agreements, and the Western world finds that it has no desire, no will to uphold the agreements. And yet, instead of learning from the experience, they keep, you know, putting their hand on the hot stove over again. It's a remarkable phenomenon. I think one of the things we should learn is to be much more realistic about what can be achieved through agreements of that kind. And for anybody who really does believe that it's important to preserve these kinds of arms control and disarmament and peace agreements, it's incumbent on them, I think, to propose right now extremely strong enforcement actions, because if this kind of violation of these agreements by Assad goes unpunished, then it is yet another severe blow to the whole idea of using any kind of international agreement for, you know, to constrain anybody in the world.
Yeah. In fact, I think it's fair to say, Doug, that we've watched these tyrants over the generations now actually being emboldened by the failure of the so-called international community, or for that matter, even just the United States in the case of bilateral agreements. There's a treaty with the Russians, as you know, actually signed with the Soviet Union before its demise, that I had a hand in, though I, at the end, thought it was likely to prove unverifiable and to be violated by the Russians, namely the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, INF Treaty. And that is, in fact, what's happening. And the scale on which it's happening is extremely worrying, as is the broader thrust of Russian policy. So I think your point is very well taken.
By the way, to show the relevance of the point, think of how many people now are hoping that we're going to solve the North Korea problem, the North Korea nuclear program problem, with an agreement with Kim Jong-un, and how many people thought that President Obama could solve the Iran nuclear agreement problem by entering into the Iran deal with that regime. And so this belief that the way to solve these problems with these tyrannical regimes that don't respect their own domestic law, let alone international law, is to create international law with them.
We will see this ending badly again, I fear.
Yeah, even though the evidence is that these agreements are a gigantic problem because they get violated over and over again. I mean, the whole Western world has basically trained, you know, our partners, our non-democratic partners in these exercises, that we've trained them to understand that if they violate the agreement, we're not going to do anything effective to punish them.
It's Pavlovian. Doug Feith, we have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more in this very special conversation with the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas J. Feith, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are having a very important and extended conversation with one of the most interesting and, I think, influential national security practitioners of our time. He is Douglas J. Feith. He served previously under President George W. Bush as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He was also a Deputy Assistant Secretary back in the day with me in the Pentagon under President Ronald Reagan. He these days is the Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute and the author of an extraordinarily important book about which we'll be speaking here in a moment, War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. And Douglas Feith, I just wanted to say the challenges that you've described here, that what do you do to impress upon bad actors like the Syrians, and let's face it, every other bad actor on the planet, most of whom are joined at the hip with these guys, are watching closely to see what costs there might be for this kind of conduct. This will all fall on the plate of a man who has just assumed, as we speak, the office of the National Security Advisor to the President, an old friend and colleague of both of ours, John Bolton. I wonder what your advice to John Bolton would be as he looks at this current set of options and the need to clearly take some.
Well, I don't think that John Bolton needs my advice. He's a very smart and talented and experienced guy. And I think he's deeply knowledgeable about the problems that we've had upholding treaties with, as you say, bad actors around the world. And I think he understands, I mean, there's several things that he understands that are really important for somebody in his position to understand. One of them is, as important as diplomacy is, and it is enormously important, it's part of our national security strategy to have good, effective diplomacy. As important as diplomacy is, there are limits to what you can accomplish with diplomacy. And I think that, you know, President Obama tended to view diplomacy as the be-all and the end-all of national security policy, and a belief that you could basically accomplish everything you need to accomplish in the world by talking to people. And I think John Bolton understands that as important as it is to talk to people, there are limits to what diplomacy can accomplish when you're dealing with regimes like the North Korean regime or the Iranian regime. And sometimes the way to deal with them is to press them, to constrain them, and not simply to seek their consent to a change of behavior. And I think he understands that we are dealing with some countries in the world that we really need to actively constrain rather than simply try to come to an agreement with.
Yeah. Now, constrain is an interesting term. It can seem to be a sort of passive action, or it can involve belligerent action. The rap on John Bolton, and we've heard a lot of it since President Trump announced his appointment, is that he's a warmonger, that he's going to thrust us, the New York Times said, he is that dangerous. He is going to thrust us into, conflicts needlessly around the world. This may be an early test of that, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on it, particularly because one of the things that he is blamed for by his critics is the war in Iraq, which you also were very much involved in. I, too, was a supporter of the removal of Saddam Hussein. Talk us through what the war and decision choices were at the time, the role John Bolton played in them, and how you think he's learned the lessons from the experience, as have the rest of us.
It would be hard for me to talk specifically about his role in the Iraq decisions. He didn't play a central role, I don't believe, in the development of Iraq policy in the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah, my understanding is that Colin Powell actually cut him out of the deliberations on Iraq in the State Department at the time.
Could be. But the question still applies, and I'll address it more to what I think was going through President George W. Bush's mind. I had more exposure to him in the discussions about Iraq in the months before we actually went to war. And I think what was important to the president was, first of all, a recognition that one doesn't go to war if there is any reasonable way to deal with the problem short of war. And in the case of Iraq, the United States recognized that the Saddam Hussein regime was enormously dangerous since at least the Gulf War of 1990-91. And from that point all the way to 2003, when the United States invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam, numerous efforts short of war had been tried to contain and constrain Saddam Hussein. There were UN resolutions, there were, you know, exhortations, calls on the Iranian regime to drop its support for terrorism and to stop threatening its neighbors. There were economic sanctions imposed that at first were very severe, and then after a while were loosened up, and then after a while Saddam figured out how to corrupt the UN officials who were running the program and completely undermine the effectiveness of the economic sanctions.
The so-called oil for food scandal.
The oil for food scandal. And then there were weapons inspections that were put in place, and they were at first very intrusive, and we learned a lot. And then after a while, Saddam figured out ways to engage in cat and mouse games with the inspectors, and then finally announced that he wasn't going to allow the inspectors to function at all, which triggered President Clinton to launch several days of bombing as a sign of disapproval for Saddam's withdrawal from the weapons inspection regime. Then we also had, there were threats that Saddam posed to Kuwait even after the Gulf War, and that led to the creation of a no-drive zone in the south. And there were threats that he made against the Kurds in the north, and that led to the creation of a no-fly zone over northern Iraq. Anyway, there was a very long series of actions from words to economic sanctions to no-fly zones, no-drive zones, exchanges of fire between the airplanes in those zones and the and Saddam's forces on the ground that were shooting at the airplanes. We had limited military strikes. There were lots of activities short of war that were tried for a dozen years. And when the dozen years was over and we looked back, what we saw was Saddam had basically systematically dismantled the various efforts that were made to constrain him. And he had completely undermined the economic sanctions. He had stopped the weapons inspections, and he was shooting at the people who were patrolling the no-fly zones. So, the general sense was that international support for tightening these measures was diminishing. And I think when President George W. Bush decided that he really didn't have any way to deal with the serious dangers that the Iraqi regime posed, and those dangers went far beyond the question of just, you know, did the Iraqis possess WMD stockpiles? When George W. Bush looked at the total range of threats coming from the Iranian regime, and he looked at it in light of the vulnerabilities that the 9/11 attack had exposed in the United States, and decided that he needed to take action against Saddam, he came to the conclusion that we had tried and exhausted all reasonable means short of war. And it was at that point, and then he even tried to prevent a war, George W. Bush did, in the last days by giving an ultimatum to Saddam to leave the country. And anyway, it was only after the total exhaustion of all these means short of war that the president concluded that he had to go to war. And I think that's the kind of analysis that any reasonable president would go through. And in other words, nobody should think that war is a good option or an easy option or the first option.
Right. And I think that is certainly true of John Bolton, from my experience with him, and I think yours, Doug Feith. Let me ask you very quickly, Doug, one of the points that seems increasingly to have been deemed the point at which the war effort against Saddam took a serious turn for the worse and a strategically mistaken turn at that, was the decision to de-Ba'athify, as it was called, the armed forces of Iraq and more generally the government, and to ultimately, shortly thereafter, disband the army as well. Jerry Bremer, who has been described as the proconsul in Iraq, who led the coalition provisional authority in the early days after the invasion, lays these decisions at your feet. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to address the record there.
Well, I'm not sure that Bremer actually said that the decisions were mine, because they weren't. There were really two main decisions that you're talking about. One of them was the de-Ba'athification policy, and the other was the decision to disestablish the army and the defense ministry.
Hey, Doug, hold the thought. We have to pause. We'll be right back with more to address these important questions and what has flowed from them with Douglas J. Feith, author of War and Decision Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back for the third installment in this special edition of Secure Freedom Radio, a conversation with Douglas J. Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a man who was in the senior reaches of the Defense Department at the time of 9/11's, well, its immediate aftermath for sure, and what then flowed from it. I wonder, Doug, if you just finish your thought on this two-part question of the decisions taken about de-Ba'athification and the extent to which the army of Iraq should have been disbanded.
All right, I'll try to deal with each in turn very briefly. On the issue of de-Ba'athification, the Ba'ath Party was dominated by the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, who represented about 20% of the population. The Shiites are about 60%, and the Kurds, who are not Arabs, are about 20%. And not all the Sunnis were Ba'athist party members in the government, but the people who dominated the Ba'ath Party were Sunni Arabs. And the Ba'ath Party was absolutely hated by virtually all the non-Sunni Arabs in the country, which is to say 80% of the country, and probably a substantial number of the Sunni Arabs as well. It was clear that something had to be done if any Iraqis were going to feel comfortable coming forward to assume leadership positions in the post-Saddam Iraq. It was clear that something had to be done to communicate to the people of Iraq that the Ba'ath Party was gone and is not coming back, because they ran a really fierce and frightening tyranny in the country. And we came up with a policy that was actually very reasonable. And it didn't reach deeply into the country. It basically affected only the top leadership of the Ba'ath Party. And the punishment for people who were in the top leadership was not anything draconian. I mean, it wasn't that they were going to be killed or even imprisoned. They were not going to be allowed to work in the government. And the other part of the policy was that the top layers of the government would not be filled by Ba'ath Party members any longer. And the third part of the policy was there could be exceptions to the first two parts. And that was the whole policy. And it got a lot of criticism that it went too far. In fact, it didn't go too far, and nobody who really understands what the policy was would have said that it went too far. What happened, though, is the Ba'ath Party was so unpopular throughout the country that lots of people spontaneously in their own areas took action against Ba'ath Party members, I mean, going all the way down to, you know, teachers in schools. And some of those actions, which got described as excessive, were blamed on a policy that didn't, in fact, require the actions. In other words, people went a lot farther in their spontaneous de-Ba'athification efforts throughout the country than was required by the policy. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the policy was. If people are interested, I explain it in my book, War and Decision, and the details are in there. Now, on the issue of the dissolution of the army, the original policy of the Bush administration was that even though there was a very strong argument for disbanding the army, because it was so unbelievably badly organized and had a terrible reputation and was corrupt.
And Sunni dominated with the ranks being Shiite populated.
Exactly. There was a really good argument for getting rid of it. We also thought that on balance, it might be better to leave it intact and reform it and use it for Reconstruction purposes. And so I personally briefed President Bush on the plan not to disband the army, but to keep it, reform it, and use it for Reconstruction purposes. And that was the policy going into the war. What happened, though, was as a result of the overthrow of the regime, the army essentially disbanded itself. And the people went home. The Shiite conscripts that you just referred to went home. The Sunni officers ran away, you know, took their uniforms off and ran away and hoped that they would not be held responsible for anything that they had done. And the facilities were absolutely stripped down. You know, the copper was pulled out of the walls. The wires were pulled out. There was nothing left but concrete slabs of buildings. All the vehicles disappeared, and the army was essentially dismantled spontaneously. And the question that Jerry Bremer then had when he was coming in is, since the premise of the policy that said we were going to use the army was that the army would have remained intact, does he really want to exert himself to reassemble the army and then try to reform it? Or, given the fact that it disbanded itself, are you better off just starting from scratch? He recommended starting from scratch. Now, let me just say, a lot of reasonable people could differ about whether that recommendation was smart or not. But the one thing that was clearly a mistake was when the Coalition Provisional Authority announced the disbanding of the army, they didn't announce something that had been talked about in Washington as a very important element of the whole policy, which was to provide stipends to the soldiers who were being sent home. Because we had talked about the danger of sending hundreds of thousands of men from the army home. Many of them would have weapons, but they wouldn't have paychecks. And we said that's a formula for disaster.
A lot of grievances. We're speaking to Douglas J. Feith, who was at the time of all of this the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And Doug, I think you've laid out what was a very reasonable approach. Let me just turn to one of the aftermaths of all of this, which again is pointed to as evidence that the war in Iraq, which you and John Bolton and I and many others supported, is that it has created a vacuum of power that has been filled now by Iran, and that it was actually predictable that that would happen, and that those who were responsible should be denied any further involvement in national security policymaking. How do you respond to that?
It was not inevitable that the overthrow of Saddam would strengthen Iran's position in the Middle East. It was understood that that was a possibility, that was a danger, and thought was given to what steps could be taken to address that danger and even how to use our military action in Iraq to help the U.S. position vis-a-vis Iran. So this was given thought, and it wasn't inevitable that the Iranians would benefit as they have. And I think a large part of the reason that they did benefit to the extent that they have is because the George W. Bush administration, which didn't do everything correct on the subject, but was, I think, you know, reasonably good on the subject of Iran, was followed by the Obama administration. And President Obama had a large strategic idea that was that the United States could forge a strategic alliance with Iran. And so it was a conscious part of U.S. policy during the Obama administration to build up the Iranians, to increase their influence in the area, and to show them I think President Obama referred to it as an unclenched fist, right, as an open hand of cooperation. And so a large part of the reason that the Iranians achieved the kind of increased influence throughout the region and got bolder and got involved, you know, from Libya to Yemen to Lebanon to Syria, and became a much more serious threat with their nuclear program and the extra financial resources they got from the nuclear deal with the United States. The reason for all of that was not that the United States overthrew Saddam Hussein. The reason for all of that is that the United States had a policy, which I think was misguided and turned out to be very damaging. We had a policy of building up the Iranians and trying to cultivate a partnership with them.
Right. And create conditions on the ground in Iraq that lent themselves to the infusion of the Iranians into that neighboring country, whether the Iraqis wanted it or not. This is an important facet of the history here that is often neglected, particularly by those who were at the time championing the strengthening of Iran. Doug Fife, let me turn to, there's so much more I want to talk with you about, but one of the things that, of course, has arisen and that John Bolton will be helping President Trump address here in the next few weeks is this sort of culmination of the embrace that you've just described by Barack Obama of Iran, namely the Joint Plan of Action, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA as it's known. What is your advice in terms of how to deal with this deal the president has, I think, correctly described as the worst in history?
Well, I think that the way to look at this is we need to have an overall strategy on Iran and the, you know, what to do about the nuclear deal is a slice of that overall policy. And the beginning of wisdom for that overall policy is the complete repudiation of the approach that President Obama took. We should recognize Iran is not a potential strategic partner of the United States. On the contrary, it's a regime that is dedicated to, as it puts it, death to America. And it's a revolutionary regime that's highly ideological. It's interested in spreading its revolution, spreading its ideology. It's been very active throughout its region and even over the years beyond its region into Europe, into Latin America, into the United States. A lot of Americans by now have probably forgotten that there were Iranian government agents who were actually arrested and convicted of a plot to blow up a restaurant in Washington, D.C., to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C., and kill, you know, presumably everybody else in the restaurant.
Indeed. A restaurant that I believe both of us have frequented from time to time. So, Doug Fife, we have to pause again for another moment. This is personal as well as of epic importance to our country. We'll be right back with more with the author of War and Decision, Douglas J. Fife, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final installment of this extraordinarily important conversation with one of the really decisive influencers during the first George W. Bush administration with respect to national security policy. He has recounted his own involvement in some of the epic decisions that were made during that period in his memoir, War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism, an extraordinarily informative and important account of what happened during that time, much of which is still being played out as we speak. And Doug, over the years, both in government and out, I know that you have taken a very keen interest in and been involved to varying degrees with the country of Turkey. In recent years, a man who has been inexorably increasing his power to the point now where he has essentially, it seems, achieved effectively dictatorial control of what was once a fairly flourishing democracy, Recep Tayyip Erdogan is involved with the nation we were talking about a moment ago, Iran, involved in Syria, attacking allies on the ground there of ours, the Kurds, and even Syrian forces, and threatening to move against, you know, areas in which our own forces, our own special operators are on the ground. We have a new book coming out this week from the Center for Security Policy entitled Ally No More, which we think pretty accurately describes the fact that Turkey, despite the nominal status of an ally in NATO, has really become a very hostile force. Your thoughts on what Erdogan is up to and what American policy should be towards him?
Erdogan is an enormously significant figure in Turkey's history. It's a very interesting thing. Turkey for centuries was in the world the Ottoman Empire, and it was it was the Muslim Caliphate, and played a major role in the history of the Middle East and the history of Europe. And after World War I, one man, through an enormous, exertion of kind of genius and leadership, transformed the Ottoman Empire into a modern Western nation state, the Republic of Turkey. And he put Turkey on the path to liberalizing and democratizing. And it was an amazing transformation of a religious-based empire into a Western liberal democratic country. And he was the man who turned the Republic of Turkey into an important ally in NATO, eventually, and into a country that became an extremely important partner of the United States throughout the Cold War. Amazingly enough, one man, Erdogan, through also a kind of brilliant, but I think very sinister politics, has worked over the last decades to undo what Ataturk was, secularizing the country so that it could function as a Western liberal democratic country. And Erdogan came in with obviously the intention of re-Islamizing the country and making it, much more connected to its religious roots and to the Muslim world, and hostile to the Western liberal democratic states that it had been such an important ally of throughout the Cold War. And what he's done is a tragedy for the many millions of Turks who were devoted followers of Ataturk and really wanted to be part of the Western world and part of an enlightened liberal and democratic world. And Erdogan has undermined Turkish democracy. He's undermined its freedoms. He's made it one of the most hostile countries in the world to journalists. He's jailed lots of journalists. He's jailed his political opponents. And he's done severe damage to Turkey's domestic institutions and to its international relations. And so your point about, is Turkey still deserving of the title of ally, is an important question to ask, because Erdogan has gone out of his way to repudiate key elements of the alliance, the nature of the country and support for policies that the Western world considers fundamental, and for example, resisting the Russian aggressions in Ukraine and resisting the Iranians and the development of their nuclear weapons. Erdogan has gone out of his way to align with the enemies of the West rather than, serve the kind of function that or have Turkey serve the kind of function that it served throughout the Cold War, which was as a crucial member of the Western alliance. Erdogan turned his back on all that.
I'll never forget, Doug Fife, you sharing with me an insight of yours years and years ago, that we think of the map of Europe with Turkey sort of off down in the lower right-hand corner and it's seemingly a marginal player. But if you put the center of the map over Turkey, which is obviously the way Erdogan looks at the world, it's in the middle of everything that is really so vital at the moment, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's vis-a-vis Israel, whether it's the challenges in Central Asia, whether it's Europe itself, and needless to say, with the flows of migrants he sent there It has had a profound influence on what's happening with respect to Europe. Doug, we are almost out of time, and there's about 12 more topics that I'm anxious to cover with you. We won't do justice even to one, but I did want to ask, at this moment, with all we've been talking about, primarily focused on the Middle East and its surroundings, there is another force that John Bolton and the rest of us are going to have to contend with, I'm afraid, that is very much, as you've been describing, feeling emboldened by some of the policies and behavior that they've seen from our country, among others, in the past. And that would be Communist China. And I just invite you to talk a little bit about your perspective on what's going on with China in the South China Sea, the One Belt, One Road initiative, its activities to build up its nuclear capabilities, to have space dominance, and so much more. How should we see China at this point, again, as an enemy or something else?
For many years, recent decades, I think that conservatives and liberals in the United States have tended to look at China with a certain amount of optimism, a certain amount of hope that we could develop a truly cooperative relationship with them. You know, there was the famous rhetoric of China being a responsible stakeholder in the world, and that's something that we wanted to encourage. And then we thought of China as a trade partner of growing importance, and we were looking to do as much business with them as possible. And there was a belief that the Chinese, because of all the trade, would get more prosperous and would liberalize their politics. What we have seen in recent years, though, is that almost all of those hopes and almost all of that optimism has been disappointed by Chinese government policy, which instead of fulfilling, you know, the dream that they would liberalize and become more cooperative and more responsible as a stakeholder in international affairs and all the rest of it, has become much more aggressive, much more militaristic, much more nationalistic in an aggressive kind of way, hostile to the United States. And now when we look at the relationship, we see that the Chinese leadership has, in its diplomacy and its military policy and its economic policy, has basically staked out a position that they view us as their enemy. And I think that is causing national security people in the United States to have to reexamine, you know, the hopes and the optimism that we had about China and its evolving cooperativeness and liberalism.
Yeah, we better be doing all of that. We wrote a book about 2 years ago now, Doug, called Warning Order, about how China is preparing for conflict and how the United States must do the same. These books of the Center for Security Policy, including the new one, Turkey as an Ally No More, will be available online for free as downloadable documents at securefreedom.org. I hope you'll check them out, as well as Doug Feith's splendid and really definitive history of the early days of the, as it was called, War on Terrorism, War and Decision, inside the Pentagon at the dawn of the War on Terrorism, as well as his work at the Hudson Institute, where he is the director of the Center for National Security Strategies. Doug, thank you so much for your time today, as well as your accumulated public service to our country. We appreciate your time, as always. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.